afternoon, we'll call to order the House Committee on Rules for Wednesday, February 27. We're going to start today with a public hearing on House Resolution 1. We'll open a public hearing on H.R. 1 and call Representative Smith, Representative Huffman, please.
Mr. Chairman, the committee, H.R. 1 honors Leo County Judge Jeannie Birch for exemplary leadership and service to the community. You did receive written testimony from OSU and from the Association of County Clerks in support of the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Gentlemen. Chair. Committee, I would like to go first because I know if I don't, there will be nothing left to say. So, actually, Representative Smith is really going to carry the water on this, but Judge Birch has been my constituent for the last 5.5 years and just a wonderful public servant, an amazing lady. She was one of the first people that I actually reached out to in 2007 when I was looking at running for the appointment. And I said, so Judge Birch, tell me about Wheeler County. What are your needs? And she said, we need cellular service. And, you know, I expect her to say we need more money, we need timber receipts, we need everything that we always hear. And I said, cellular service? Well, maybe I can help you with that. And we were able within 2 years to have the first cell site turned on in Wheeler County. And so she's just an amazing lady and fun to work with, and I'm really going to miss her in Wheeler County. So Rep. Smith and I wanted to get together and honor a neat lady.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, representing District 57. Just very, very briefly, I've known Jean Birch for 2 decades now, and where I really knew that she was a great lady is as she was getting ready to retire, I looked on her wall, and she had 2 plaques, and one was from United States Senator Ron Wyden, and the other one was from U.S. Congressman Greg Walden. And both of them recognized her for her dedication in leading Oregon's smallest county. And when I saw that, I just knew that the state of Oregon also needed to have its opportunity to recognize this fine lady. And that's why we bring House Resolution 1 forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is that all you have to say, Representative Smith?
That is it, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for our colleagues?
We'll save the rest for the floor speech.
Thank you both very much for bringing this resolution to us.
Thank you.
Some more testimony? Okay. Close public hearing on H.R. 1. I'll open a work session on H.R. 1.
Mr. Chair, I move H.R. 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves H.R. 1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes, and H.R. 1 is moved to the floor. We'll have Representative Smith, Representative Huffman co-carry that resolution. We'll open a public hearing on, thank you, House Bill 2708, and call Representative Olson, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2708 provides the specified portion of Oregon Route 34 shall be known as Eric McKinley and Tyler Troyer Highway, Hero Memorial Highway, directs Oregon Department of Transportation to place suitable markers. There is a dash one amendment and a hand engrossed version of that amendment in your materials. The dash one amendment provides that specified portions of the highway shall be known as Eric McKinley and Tyler Troyer Highway Memorial. It expands the use of the Roadside Memorial Fund to include fallen hero roadside memorial signs to recognize and honor those killed in action or died as a result of wounds received while serving in armed forces of the United States. Directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to set and collect fee for costs associated with roadside memorial, and directs Oregon Department of Transportation to establish size, design, and location of roadside memorial sign. There is a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. No statement was issued.
Aaron, good job. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Andy Olson, and I am the state representative from the Albany area. I'd like to have you focus on the dash one amendments because that does change up a little bit the direction of where we're going with House Bill 2708. Essentially, what the dash one amendments does is it locates places signs in 2 different locations on Highway 34, both in Linn County and over in Benton County. The signs recognize Eric McKinley, who graduated from Philomath High School, and also Tyler Troyer, who graduated from West Albany High School. The dads, the fathers, Tom McKinley and Michael Thorpe, are going to be up here in just a few minutes, and they're going to kind of fill in a little bit more for you with this. But I'm just going to kind of give you a little brief to give you a head start on some of this as well. But Army Specialist Eric McKinley was 24 years old when he was killed in 2004 by a roadside bomb north of Baghdad that destroyed two vehicles and wounded four other Oregon soldiers. Eric's six-year tour of duty with the National Guard was to have ended April 1st, but his stay was extended indefinitely because of the continuing violence that was happening over in Iraq at that time. Eric was assigned to the Company B, 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry Regiment, with the National Guard out of Corvallis. He was born in Salem. He attended Philomath High School. And I will stop right there with describing a little bit of Eric. These are great kids, let me tell you. And this is pretty neat to be able to do this. And I greatly appreciate you listening to this, and, you know, and the potential of moving it forward. And yes, it sounds kind of bleak right now, but I'll tell you, this is a great opportunity for us to honor these guys, and especially the families. Tyler Troyer was born in Corvallis on June 7th, 1984. He started playing baseball about age 7 and loved to watch the Mariners. He was a West Albany High School's only left-handed pitcher and helped lead the team to the playoffs in 2002 for the first time in 41 years. I happened to watch that game. Troyer's coaches had said that Tyler was always one of the hardest workers on the team, and his love for the game was evident. Troyer was 17 years old when he started talking about joining the Marines, and when 9/11 occurred, he knew he wanted to defend our country. His parents gave him their love and support and signed his papers. I got to stop right there. But anyways, honestly, I really do want to have Michael and Tom come up and share a little bit with you, too. So if you guys would come on up and just kind of fill in a little bit of gaps, I'd appreciate it. The other thing, too, I want you to know, I greatly appreciate ODOT, the Department of Transportation, on this, especially from the last 2 years where we've been involved in placing signs on the highway system throughout the state for fallen police officers. And Paul Mather from ODOT will be here as well. But those guys have gone way beyond in helping us with that. And again, they're here with that same type of attitude and mentality, and we appreciate that. So if you guys.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you would just state your names for the record as you start.
My name is Tom McKinley, father of Specialist Eric McKinley. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing us today. Eric was very well known in his community. He was the type of person that would go out of his way to help somebody else. So many of the kids these days are so self-contained in what they're doing for themselves that they don't take the time to look and see what they can do for somebody else. And Eric, at a very early age, took on that type of mentality. The biggest conflicts he had in his life were his tattoos and his piercings, because being in the military, you have to cover those and take piercings out. But he was more than willing to make that adjustment for his military service. And as Mr. Olson said, his 6 years was up, but because of the ongoing conflicts, they extended his time, and regardless of whether they would have extended it or not, he still would have gone, because the guys that he served with for 6 years in the community were going to go anyway, and he wasn't going to let them go by themselves. When he was over in Iraq, and this just goes to say that he cared more about other people than he did himself. There was a family that was living underneath a bridge. Their home had been destroyed. They barely had electricity. They had makeshift somehow to get electricity underneath this bridge so they'd have electricity. He took his TV and his Game Boy and everything that he had and gave it to this family. He befriended the family because they drove by him every day when they go out for looking for insurgents, And so he got to know them. And just a great kid. You know, I could sit here and talk about him all day, but my whole desire in getting this passed is we have nice memorials. We have a very nice one here in Salem over by the Veterans Building or Veterans Administration Building that MJ and Clay Kesterson spearheaded. But unless you stop and get out of your car, physically walk into it and start reading the names, you don't know who's there. And I know every time I go down I-5 between here and Corvallis, as I'm headed back north, I see the sign on the side of the road for our fallen officer that was killed out there on I-5. And I remember him every time I pass that sign. And I'd like to see something like that for my son.
My name is Michael Thorpe. Tyler Troyer is my son. And I lost him in 2005. I consider for a long time and, you know, kind of talk about what kind of a kid he was. Even after 7 years, it's still hard to talk about. I think one thing that motivates me, and I think Tom echoes on it too, is, you know, there's lots of things around this country that have the names chiseled on them for, you know, not just the people from Oregon, but from all the other states, you know, in these conflicts and prior wars as well. And like you said, unless you get out and look at these and read them, say, oh, I might know that guy. In all the communities across, you know, the state, there are families who lost part of themselves, and a lot of times people don't even know that these people live in their own communities, and they suffer. The war in Iraq is winding down. It's no longer front page news. Even Afghanistan, no longer front page news. Somebody dies, gets killed, loses their life there. Now it's third, fourth page back. It's not. It's already being. You know, other things are more important now, and so it's easy to forget. But you know, all these kids, and these are kids, right out of high school. You know, my son walked away from an American Legion baseball game, and he got an opportunity to join early, and he did. He walked away, turned his uniform in, and in 2 weeks he was off to boot camp. And he walked away from something that he was very, very passionate about, and that's playing baseball. And he wanted to serve this country, and he did. And you know, he paid the ultimate price, you know, for that. And like Tom stated, it's with everything fading into the background. And even when I come up I-5 to Salem today, you see the two crosses on the side of the road, and you see that brown sign with the two state police officers killed in the line of duty, and it makes you look. You have to look, and I'd like to see that state of Oregon do that, not just for my son or not just for Tom's, but there's lots of other husbands, sons, and daughters, and wives lost their lives as well, and I think that's it'd be a good program because nowhere in the state is there such a thing. I had the opportunity to spend last Memorial Day in Canton, Massachusetts, and I stayed with a family whose son was killed October 6, 2005. He was a friend of my son's. And so this is a small community, smaller than Albany. And just going around this small town, the patriotism is stupendous. There's, you know, Lance Corporal Shane Cabino is his name. He has a $20 million bridge named in his honor. On both sides of this bridge, there's Marine Corps flags going down the protective railing, and on his name is on both sides of this bridge. And he actually got to see the bridge being constructed before he deployed, but he never knew that his name was going to be on it. And what a thing of honor that will be there for the test of time, that anybody that travels over that bridge are going to see that sign. And that got me thinking, too, when I got home. It's like my drive down all these highways, I see nothing. And I'd like to see that now happen in this state. The state of Missouri has a great program where they work with the Missouri Department of Transportation, and they've started a program where people can work with their legislature and get bills passed, and it doesn't cost taxpayers money, and they can have signs made and have designate stretches of highways and roads in the communities where these kids grew up. And that's what's important, is where they grew up. I know on Highway 34, I'm sure my son broke the speed limit a few times going down that highway. One of the signs will be, the placement of one of those signs actually will be at the road that you turn to go to the cemetery where he's buried. And he didn't know that, but when he brought up that name of that street, it's like, you know, that's where I turned to go to the cemetery to go visit my son at the cemetery. So I think that, and my wife works in Corvallis, and she would see that all the time too. But if you think about how many people travel Highway 34 each and every day, you know, people are going to look at that sign. Maybe they'll get used to it if they travel it every day. But if you look at all the tourism and people, they're going to remember, you know, the names and the sacrifices that these kids made for our country. That's really all I've got to say, and I want to thank you for considering this bill and letting me testify.
Thank you both very much for coming here to share these stories. Paul Mather from ODOT.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, really here just to answer any questions you may have. As Representative Olson talked about, we worked together with him to develop the Fallen Officer Program last session. We've worked in the interim to implement that, and it's been a successful program, I think, all the way around, and really see this kind of following that footsteps in the same process as we've developed over the last couple of years. So really here just to answer any questions.
I don't think we have any, but thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2708. We can move it, right?
We can.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2708. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2708.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2708. Is there a discussion on the motion? Representative
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Rip Olson for bringing this forward and, you know, for creating such a moving context for us. And I want to thank both you gentlemen. And this, you know, this is an inadequate but completely fitting tribute to your sons. So thank you very much.
Further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the -1 amendments are adopted. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 2708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? I just want to add my thanks, Representative, for your diligent work in making sure that this body takes these steps to honor people who have given their lives for our state and our country, and thank you, gentlemen, both for being here. The motion is, I see no objection, the motion passes, and House Bill 2708 is moved to the floor. And Representative Olson, will you carry it, please?
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2708 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2206.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2206 allows Secretary of State to assume election-related duties, functions, or powers of county clerk of county for which governor has declared public safety services emergency, requires funds retained by the Director of Veterans Affairs Department out of distribution to county without county veteran service officers to be spent to provide veteran services in that county in manner deemed appropriate, authorizes county to request declaration by governor of emergency in county that is providing less than minimal adequate property tax assessment and collection services, requires Director of Department of Consumer Business Services to enter into agreement to combine resources for the purpose of administrating and enforcement of municipal building inspection program if municipality is not carrying out program or at the request of public body. We have not received a fiscal nor a revenue statement on the measure as such.
Thank you. We will start with agency panel from Department of Revenue, I believe. So please come forward and introduce yourselves.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips. I do work for the Oregon Department of Revenue, but I also work on special projects for the COO's office at the Department of Administrative Services. I am here today to, with my colleagues, to talk to you about this bill. As you know, there are a number of counties, timber counties, that are in serious fiscal crisis right now, and there's the possibility that in the event that one of them has determines that it's unable to continue services for the public and for our businesses in those counties, that we thought it prudent to have a plan to back up for continuation of services in those counties. The four areas we've identified as being critical and without explicit authority would be for a certain assumption of veteran services officers, certain election functions, building codes and inspections, and also the tax collection and assessment functions. So we'd like to talk about those four areas in the four sections today, if we could. Do you want to start, Mitch? Are you okay?
Chairman Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Sparks, and I work for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'd like to, I've come here today to explain a section of House Bill 2206 that pertains to veterans services through a county veteran service officer and how the state would assume those duties should a county not provide that service. Under ORS 408.410, a county may appoint a veteran service officer to provide veteran service. The county veteran service officer program is an opt-in program and not a mandate for the counties. Every county in Oregon has a service officer with the exception of Marion and Polk. ODVA Salem handles those two counties. Under current statute, if a county providing veteran services opts out of the program, monies passed through ODVA to that county are redistributed to the remaining counties providing services. House Bill 2206 amends that statute to ensure that ODVA maintains those pass-through dollars, which then must be used to continue services in that county. There are several ways the agency could continue these services, including we could contract the existing veteran service officer to continue their work, ask an adjacent county to provide the service, contract with a separate entity to provide the service, have a state VSO provide the service, and last, provide a regional VSO, a state VSO, to circuit ride throughout the region, much like the campus veteran service officer program did previously. The option we would choose would be based on the circumstances of the county or counties that opt out. Our piece of House Bill 2206 has one more component. The United States Department of Veterans Affairs plans to go paperless for their claims by June 2013. This means that all claims filed will have to be done electronically. Last session, the LFO indicated that their reading of the current statute allowed the agency to bring each county into a centralized computer system for this purpose. Our reading of that statute left us uncomfortable as to our ability to do so. We have strengthened that language in House Bill 2206 to ensure every county filing claims under the authority of ODVA uses our cloud-based system called Vetrospect. I'm happy to report that nearly every county has voluntarily signed up for this system, which only costs $399 per user per year when signed up under our user agreement. This system will allow every CVSO and state VSO to file claims electronically with the federal VA. And thank you, and do you have any questions?
Let's go ahead and wait till the end of the panel, and we'll take questions for the three of you.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the administrator of state building codes. We're a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're part of the bill in really a proactive manner. I'll just tell you a little bit about our organization. Not many folks aren't familiar with building codes. We set standards, uniform construction standards around the state, and we work with the roughly 130 city and county building departments that are out there providing services on a statewide basis. This bill allows us to proactively, if there's a program that's either suffering because of economic conditions, that whether it's on the timber payment side, general fund issues, or just poor economic condition, to proactively work with our counties and cities to develop agreements where we can partner with them, combine state and local government resources, our resources that allow us to recognize the local fees if we need to, if we go in and provide those services or set specific fees in that particular area. I guess just the bottom line is we believe, I'm going to show a map here real quick. Everybody can see this is a pretty close room. All the orange areas are the counties and cities that have experienced in the last 5 years a 40 to 80% decline in their building permit revenue. And I'll remind the group that building permit revenue is not general fund revenue. It's paid for by the contractor or customer that's requesting the service. We believe many of these areas are significantly struggling and may return parts or need help from the state to keep their programs viable. And we think that's in the best interest of everybody to keep that local viability. So this bill will give us the flexibility to address those requests if they come to us. And with that, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Berger. If I could cover section three, unless there's a question.
Yeah.
No.
Whatever you want.
Well, I would like a lot. Unfortunately, my computer just went down, so I can't read the bill. And I would like to know a lot more about the governor's powers to declare a public service emergency before we get too much further into this, and what that would look like. And we last session in this committee had a discussion about public safety and those powers, which made a lot of sense because those are very immediate. These are less immediate services that counties do provide. I'm just a little concerned that what this bill does is just give a kind of a easy way for counties to get off the hook or just bring in the state, and what's the exit strategy once the state comes in? Public safety is an immediate concern. These are concerns that don't rise quite to that sense of immediacy, so I'm not feeling quite what the emergency is here, Mr. Chair, and I guess I would like testimony to help explain that to me.
That sounds like a good idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can speak specifically to the Section 3 declaration. Is that the one you're talking about, or are you talking about the Section 1 declaration?
Both? The governor declares a public safety emergency for a county.
Go to Section 3.
Oh. Yes. In Section 1, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, we have had conversations with the counties about that trigger. I'm not exactly sure the genesis of that language, but we're not really sure if that's the best fit for an election situation, if there be a public safety emergency. So we would like to explore that, other options for that trigger, and perhaps what I'll do is chat with you about it at some point at your convenience to see if you have an idea also that might be useful. The trigger in Section 3 is the part where the county would request the governor to declare an emergency for the property tax assessment or the collection function. And this gives the governor the ability, first it gives the county the option, it doesn't mandate it, but it gives the county the option to ask, and then it gives the governor the option to decline. So if there is a concern that, there is a concern, especially on the Department of Revenue's part, that a county might just say, here, take our program. We can't afford to run it. But we also want to be able to catch those services that are falling through, and collection is one of them that affects all local governments. And so if there was a situation that that demanded the need for that at least there'd be a backup. There'd be some way to collect the taxes in the event that the county was not funding the tax collector or there was no FTE in that office. So that's how Section 3 works. It's basically the county makes a decision, they may ask, and then the governor, in consultation with the director of the Department of Revenue, would then either declare the emergency or say, no, there's no emergency. Now, we do, as routine for the Department of Revenue, do audits of counties, reviews of counties. Every year we look at their grants so we know how many staff they have, how many they've cut, what their dollar commitment is. So we know every year, from year to year, what their dollar commitment is to those programs. So when they do cut back, we're keenly aware of that, and that's some of the conversation we're having specifically with certain timber counties right now. We're very concerned that if and when those positions are cut, there won't be sufficient staff to step in and do that work. So that's how the trigger works for Section 3. I've said this before, and I'll say it again.
if the Department of Revenue had to step in and take over a county tax collection or assessment function, we feel we would be not doing near as good of a job as the county is currently doing, because they know the county, they know their clientele, they know the property, they're good at what they do. We really prefer not to have this happen. But if it does happen, there should be some mechanism for somebody to take over and do something. Now, it does give, we think it's the latitude is broad enough to give the Department of Revenue the latitude to enter into intergovernmental agreements to have another county help that county, or for us to have an intergovernmental agreement that county for its own staff. So there wouldn't necessarily have to be an interruption of the people in the positions that are doing the job. So it's just a way of bridging. And to follow up with your other question, when do these things end? Well, we really don't know the future on how these counties are going to deal with their funding situation. I believe there's some efforts to deal with ongoing stabilization of county funding at the national level and at the state level. And that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about what happens if none of those solutions work out. Should we have something in place? I hope that helps to answer some of your questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 3 of the bill, which we haven't gotten to, I think, yet, but it does explicitly state within the bill the condition for state intervention. It would be triggered upon basically the county's determination of an emergency status. So the state can't come in unless the county invites them. Section 1 has a reference to a statute 203095, and my reading of that is that it has a similar requirement, actually the same kind of requirement, that an emergency must be determined first by the board of the governing body of a county. County commissioners, only upon that determination may the state come in and take over these services, right? And so
the state can say no.
So can you comment on these issues?
Yes, I believe there's someone here from the Secretary of State's office that might respond to that.
Okay, we can save that for later then, or
okay.
But I think that's what we're getting at here, because the state shouldn't be able to just come in and override a county's governing body and declare that it's going to take over these functions, whether this is considered an emergency or not. You've got to be invited in, but I do see that protection present in the bill in sections 1 and 3.
I would like to hear from the counties, Mr. Chair, and the Secretary of State, on how this actually works, because
we will.
There's a lot more information out there.
Do you want to
These folks are fine. They know how to take over these functions. I want to know what triggers it, what makes it go away, and how this interplays intergovernmentally.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in understanding how the payment system works.
Yes.
I don't see anything in Section 1, and it may be just that I just missed it, on how the Secretary of State is to be reimbursed for assuming any or all election-related duties, functions, or powers of the county clerk, as suggested in the bill. Further, I'm interested in Section 3 talks about the way in which the state would be reimbursed for, the Department of Revenue would be reimbursed for providing the services of the Department of Property Tax Assessment. It seems pretty clear that if I read this correctly, that what happens in that situation is that the other taxing districts will pay those fees through the fee that's payable from the county's unsegregated tax collections account, unless I misunderstand what the unsegregated tax collections account is. And so there, if that's true, I think the committee needs to understand that we're making a shift of the payment for these services from the county funds to the districts that the county collects property tax dollars from, from property taxpayers. That's as far as I've gotten. The first part of it is, how does Secretary of State get paid? Second part is, have I correctly understood the way the Department of Revenue gets reimbursed in Section 3? And I would simply earmark that for the committee as a policy question, if that's true.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, your question displays your years of experience on the Revenue Committee.
understanding what the unsegregated tax collection account is. And yes, that is true. Currently, current law provides the Department of Revenue can step in and take over the assessment function, the appraisal function for a county. And where do we get repaid for that? Two sources. One, the grant fund. Every county that applies for and gets a grant every year gets that money. We distribute that money. Under current law, we could hold that money from that county and spend it to support that county or have it redistributed to all the other counties. But we would use it to support that county. Secondly, it provides that any state shared revenues that the county might get could also be used to pay for the Department of Revenue's involvement in whatever way we have to support that county. I just did some numbers on that, and if we took, let's say, one particular southern Oregon coastal county example, and we had to step into that county and we assumed the functions or worked with that county on those functions and incurred costs, we could take their CAFA grant and we could take the state shared services, and that would total 36% of the cost of their cost of running their own program. So we know that between those two revenue sources, there's not enough money to reimburse us for our work, even if we could do the work as efficiently as they are currently doing it, which we likely wouldn't. So we had to think of another source. This particular solution came from what is now Senate Bill 15, which came from the Treasury. The Treasury will talk later about their concern about the situation of having the assessment or taxation office fail to function in a county. They came up with an idea, and that idea for using these revenues was borrowed then for this bill. That's the genesis of that solution. And so where that money comes from then is for all the property taxes that are collected in the county, they go into a pot of money that's then distributed to each district based on their proportional share of their levies to the total amount levied. And that's where this money would come from. I'd like to respond to your earlier comment and say that it's very important for us in all four of these sections to make sure that it's not too easy to get the state to come in, and it's for the state to assume responsibilities in a county that the county doesn't want, nor do we want it to be a situation where it's easy for the opposite to happen, for the county to turn over the responsibilities. So we'd be happy to work on any amendments or ideas that would promote those two.
Mr. Chair, that being the case, I would suggest that we make certain that there's some kind of a reference in Section 3 to those other funds. Right now, it would appear, and I haven't looked at the other statutes, so I may be off base, but it would appear that this bill would establish the fee as shall be payable from the county's unsegregated tax collections account. It doesn't mention these other accounts at all. And if those other accounts are to be continue to be used for the purposes as Mr. Phillips indicates, it would seem to me that ought to be referred to in here, so it's completely clear that they should wipe out the CAFA account and the other funds account before they go after the unsegregated tax collections account.
We'd be happy to work on that.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Representative Deborah.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have a general question. I'm not sure if this panel is the appropriate one to ask it to. So this bill came to us from DAS. Is that the source of this? And why does it mention these functions and not others? I mean, how was the decision made that, we focus on the tax collection, the veterans, the elections, et cetera? I don't know if any of you can answer that. I mean, there are other important functions that the counties do and that would be affected by this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, I became involved in this concept in July, and by that time it had already evolved, but I believe where it had come from is ongoing discussions with agency heads and representatives to say, what are the issues in the counties? Where are you seeing programs that are at risk? And these, among others, surfaced, and the solutions for these particular four entities
seem to be appropriate to combine into one bill.
Although, I mean, it just seems if, you know, if we were to get to the point where a decision was made that, you know, an emergency existed, there are going to be other agencies affected, other functions affected, and, you know, will we be able to deal with those in a timely manner, or should we anticipate those up front and make sure they're part of this?
Mr. Chair, could I speak to that briefly? Last session on in this committee, I believe we passed a bill that spoke to the most, and this is dovetailing onto it, and maybe our administrator could get us more information on the bill that dealt with public safety, which would be the most immediate issue. And it came out of a work group that worked on a number of these things, and I presume this is sort of a continuation of this effort. It wasn't quite framed that way, but so I agree with you, there could well be others that we're not thinking of, but it started with public safety, and I think I need more context like everybody else for this bill, but these are other county functions, and where they would enter in is kind of an important issue. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that comment. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I think we have some other testimony which may help shed some more light. Brenda Bays and Laura Lockwood, please. Laura Lockwood McCall, sorry.
Good afternoon. For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall from the State Treasurer's Office. I oversee the Debt Management Division, and I may be to blame for bringing this to Bill. One of the things that my office oversees is something called the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program. And through that guarantee program, we basically put the state's credit rating on the line for school districts. And the way we do that is that we basically promise that if the property taxes that have been collected to pay the GO voter-approved debt service on GO bonds, for some reason the money's not there, then the state will step in and make that debt service payment. We've never made that payment. I hope that we set up procedures that will never make that payment. But as we were thinking about fiscal distress counties and the likelihood that a school district wouldn't have enough money to pay their debt service payments, even with all the sort of thing, the tripwires that we've created over the years, our big concern was property tax assessment and collection. Not very exciting. It's not the public safety side of it. It's something very simple and mundane, which is the way we would reimburse ourselves if we ever made that debt service payment is we take the school state aid. Oh, dear. So that would be a situation where they weren't getting all their property tax money in the first place to operate. And then to make matters worse, we'd have to go in and basically take the dollars that we made out of the state's pocket to reimburse ourselves for that guarantee that we've made. We currently have $3.2 billion of school bonds that we've guaranteed. In any given year, that represents about $365 million of school state aid. And this is, community colleges as well as schools, K-12. So that's just around 11% of all the state aid we may do in a year. So again, it's not a public safety emergency, but if there is an emergency, I would rather see counties spend their money on public safety rather than on something as boring as property tax assessment and collection. But we still need it because there's this huge risk to both the states, you know, actually coming out of pocket, but even more and much more worse is the likelihood that a school district, through no fault of its own, would have some of its state aid taken away. So we were looking for solutions that in that worst case scenario where Department of Revenue needed to step in to make sure that we never were in a position where we were shorted, that they would be covered with their operating costs. So I think that the suggestions Representative Barnhart has suggested, we just didn't know what the details of net of these other funding sources makes a lot of sense to us. And if you saw Senate Bill 15, Section 3 of this bill and that bill are the same and could use some improvement if we're going to move forward with this concept.
Ms. Bays.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the State Elections Deputy Director. I'm just going to respond to you on Section 1 regarding the elections process. Currently, the statute only allows for the county clerk to conduct any elections throughout the state. And this, As we all know, there are some counties that may be facing fiscal issues and may not be able to have the funds to conduct elections. This is just a mechanism for the secretary to be able to go in with the help of another county clerk or whatever we need to be able to conduct those elections for that county.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. How do we pay for those elections now? And is this bill simply transfer the election conducting authority? Is the payment still going to be managed the same way? Or is that missing from this bill somehow?
Thank you, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. Currently, the statute provides that the elections are conducted by the counties and that they are funded through the county funds, the treasury of the county. That is not in here as you speak.
Well, if I could follow up. So if the Secretary of State had to conduct an election at this point, at least we're talking about small counties, but who knows, how much would it cost and who would pay for it?
Representative Barnhart, I can tell you that it's a hard number to get to because depending on the county, the size of the county, how many candidates on the ballot, how many measures are on the ballot. Right now, approximately, it is $3.80 per ballot for an election. And it depends upon how many registered voters, so how many ballots go out, how big the ballots are.
Could I continue to follow up?
Please.
Same kind of issue, but different topic generally. Would you have access to the voting, the scanning machines and other things the county might own in order to conduct this election, or would you have to take ballots to Salem to conduct the election there? Do you have authority under this statute to take over their equipment and use it?
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, I believe we can just go in and use their equipment that they currently have or bring their equipment to wherever we need it to be to conduct the elections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to clarify, can you explain what existing authority is for the Secretary of State to assume elections functions? I thought there was some existing authority in law for you to intervene. In fact, I think that something like that happened in Clackamas County last fall because of some issues there. Can you just explain how this relates to existing law?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently the Secretary of State has the authority to oversee all elections conducted throughout the states, the uniformity of those elections, and that they are conducted in compliance with Oregon election laws. We don't have the authority because it specifically says in statute that only the county clerk actually conducts the election. That's what we don't have currently, that we couldn't actually go in and conduct it ourselves.
Okay, and following up on Representative Barnhart's questioning, without language in the bill that describes any method of reimbursement, what's your expectation of who foots the bill for the $3.80 per ballot?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently for special elections, the state pays for all special elections. The county pays for all the other elections through their county funds. So without language specifying who would pay for all types of elections, it would be assumed that the state would pay for conducting those elections.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being a little bit late to this hearing, but I was sort of curious to take a step back. I don't know if this is the correct panel to ask the question, but I'm kind of curious about how this all gets initiated, going back to Representative Berger's question about the governor declaring a public safety service emergency. And I would assume that happens when the county stops providing public safety services, that the state recognizes some sort of emergency. And I'm curious, has that happened in the state of Oregon yet?
To my knowledge, through the chair.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. Well, the reason I ask is I'm just curious because I know many counties are going through cutbacks right now, laying off sheriffs and jails are, you know, beds are disappearing and you can't hold people. So those sorts of things are happening right now, and I'm curious, at what point does the state start backfilling those services at a cost to the state now,
that have been previously covered by the counties, and is that the trigger that declares the emergency? I don't know, because I'm wondering if that isn't really happening right now, and so I'm wondering who can answer that question of when, at what level of service does the emergency get triggered. And I understand the real necessity to keep the property tax payments coming in, because if you don't, it's sort of a snowball effect and all services start shutting down if you start losing your revenue stream. And, you know, I mean, it just sort of keeps snowballing. So at some point, I'm just kind of curious, you know, when does this become a big enough issue that, you know, the state's resources are being used and that trigger happens, which starts all of this potential process?
Through the chair, I'm not the budget director, but my guess is the moment timber payments are no longer available from the federal government. And I think we've been continuing to see one-year extensions of timber payments at reduced rates, so that it's a slow slide rather than an abrupt drop-off. But I think that is a very good question, and that's one of the reasons my group decided that we felt like it was important that we bring some legislation and start planning. I can't speak for DAS, but I think it's similar, kind of just wanting to plan ahead, at least on these issues that are sort of the mundane back office type of work.
Representative Denbro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on the elections question. So, you know, if the state found itself in a position to have to, you know, pay for the elections, It's possible that the county commission could continue to authorize elections that the state would have to pay for, could put additional, you know, items on the ballot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Denbro, the statute would have to be changed in order for that to occur. The statute that I'm referring to is where it specifically says that the county governing body shall provide the funds to conduct elections in the county.
Mm-hmm. But I'm following up, just you know, under what we're trying to do here, would that accomplish that?
I believe it would.
Okay. Because that makes me a little nervous, you know, that, I mean, I wouldn't want to see the county putting things on the ballot that they're not paying for, except perhaps something that might bring revenue in. I would welcome that.
Any further questions? Representative Hicks.
So, the elections piece, and just I'm working it through. I mean, how would this really play out? So, as I've kind of indicated earlier, in Section 1, the 203.095 statute would seem to require the county to invite the state to come in. Well, if the county sort of refused and yet hit a point at which they were no longer funding elections, how would that play out? Possibly someone would then, like, sue in federal court on a 1983 claim and say that their civil rights are being violated. A federal judge could theoretically then order the county to, through injunction, to start running the elections again. And if they didn't, and then the federal judge would read the law as it is, it says the county must fund the election. And so that would put the commissioners into a corner, and to which point they'd basically have no choice other than bringing the state in. So it does, and that level kind of makes sense to put elections into this bill in terms of why does it have to be there. I don't see any other alternative right now. Is that adding up for you? Does that sound right?
That sounds correct to me.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, thank you both for being here, for your testimony. We have three more folks testifying. Chris Fick, Mike Eliason, and Gil Riddell, please.
And Mr. Chair, as these gentlemen come up, I wanted to respond to Representative Berger. There were three bills that passed in 2012, 4175, 4176, and 4177, that all addressed county need in the event of a fiscal emergency or needing to access additional revenues. 4176 is the one specific to the declaration of emergency from the governor, and it set forth the criteria that an assessment by the county that is unable or will be unable to provide a minimal adequate level of state-required services, the county having received in the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2007, federal payments under the Rural Schools and Community Development money. And it set forth the consultation between the governor and the county and other parties to gather information about the state-required services and a plan to balance and then to back out of the plan. And it did come through House Rules Committee in 2012.
Excuse me, the numbers of the three bills again here.
I'm sorry, 4175, and that had the ability to access county road funds for counties, 4176, which set forth the fiscal distress counties fund and the declaration of fiscal emergency, and 4177.
Thanks, sir.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, Michael Elias, and Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here strictly to speak to Section 1. Most of what I was going to say has already been covered in discussion. I merely was going to bring up that what we thought from the perspective of county election directors, county clerks, is that the nexus between of a stating tying a takeover, not a takeover, but Secretary of State's office running elections, being tied to a public safety services emergency might not be the appropriate nexus for this particular section. And no objection for what hopefully would actually never be needed, but in the off chance that it is, maybe just getting the language a little tighter in terms of stating, maybe even something similar to the first paragraph in Section 3, where a county may not be able to provide a minimally adequate level of the conduct of elections, just tying it more to elections and not to public safety. It had the feel, has a feel of sort of placeholder language, because that 203.095 public safety emergency, you know, language is already in statute, but probably could be tweaked. I've talked to folks from the governor's office and the Secretary of State's office, and we could probably tweak that very easily. But again, no county right now is at all eager to give up conducting elections, and I'm quite sure the Secretary of State's office is not eager to begin doing that for counties. But in terms of this as a safeguard, we have no objection to it with a little tweaking of the language.
Any objection to the state paying for the elections?
No objection. I did want to, Chair Garrett, mention that right now the way it works is the county general fund covers the conducting elections for the state at the primary and general elections for state offices, for city offices. Special districts actually pays a share for their offices that are put, or their issues that are put on the ballot. But right now it is a county general fund operation. And again, the bill is basically silent to what would happen. So that would be, as you've already talked about and at length, something that would need to be discussed further.
So I just, your interpretation, if the bill is silent and the current statute says counties fund the elections, this says the state comes in to conduct them. It does not speak to funding. Do you share the interpretation that the state then assumes the responsibility for paying for them?
Chair Garrett, I'll be perfectly honest. I don't think it's entirely clear. I'm not entirely clear what would happen in that case. And so I don't want to say that I know that for sure, because I honestly don't.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I thought I'd provide just a wee bit of background. This, what you're seeing, is a work product that has evolved through, that started the discussion with the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services in 2008, which reported their recommendations in January 2009. That was a response to, at the time, a pending end of the Secure Rural Schools / County Payments Law. As it turned out, after the recommendations were made, the federal government was able to reauthorize it at a lesser amount, and has continued to be reauthorized at a lesser amount ever since. Until now, it's expired again. In the course of those considerations, what do counties do? What do they do with the state? What can they do if they don't have the money? What can the state do? We talked about emergencies, and public safety was the most immediate one, of course. But these other items are quite significant. Recall that the property tax system raises $5.2 billion a year. 46% of that goes to schools. If you have a non-functional county collecting property taxes, the schools lose more than the county. And a lot of these counties have very low permanent rates, thanks to Measure 50.
So their share of the property taxes that they collect for everybody else can be as low as 12%. And that doesn't provide enough money for them to do it right. So we have over time, since the 1989, the collaborative group that created the Assessment and Taxation Funding Program, we've continued to try to, to try to keep it cobbled together and chugging along, but it's been difficult. We have had, the lesser ability for counties to provide their share of general fund. We've had the CAFA account, the State A&T Fund, which provides the grants that John Phillips mentioned to you, recede to the point where now it's going to be under 20% of the cost. The original idea was to have it be 35%. It's never done that. So it's not working the way it is. Among the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force in January 2009, there were three of them on beefing up the Assessment and Taxation Fund, none of which has been acted on. In fact, in 2009, the legislature swept the $5 million they were putting into that fund for other purposes. So they, in fact, have weakened the state commitment to it. So the situation is you have counties that have to choose between finally just closing down the jail and having the sheriff say, I give up, I can't do this all by myself, or have an assessor operating a situation like this. And it's an untenable position. I haven't heard of any county governing body member say they want the state in doing their business. That's not the way they ran for office. So that isn't what this is about. It's not an easy offload. What it does in concept is it gives the local voters a view of what the future holds. If they don't do their share, and maybe provide some more resources locally. We have three counties that are distressed counties that are going out this spring for ballot measures. And we haven't seen success thus far. We're hoping we get over the hump, but this is a very, very profoundly serious time. Nobody wants to use these mechanisms, but it seems that once you talk it through and once you tweak it so that it makes sense to you, that it's good to have on the books in case it does happen. So,
thank you. Mr. Fick.
Chair Garrett, other members of the committee, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. We obviously share the concerns that have been expressed here, particularly about Section 5 and as it relates to assessment and taxation. We are reliant on the county to collect our property taxes, and that's an extremely important function that we value. But the concerns that we have center around what Rep. Barnhart articulated regarding access to the unsegregated accounts. As Gil Riddell said, we don't think that any county would be in a rush to declare that they are fiscally distressed, but we worry that giving counties access or the state access to unsegregated accounts to pay for this function is a lifeline with no end in sight. And instead of helping perform that function adequately, pulls down other taxing districts, cities, schools, special districts, who are similarly harmed by the same issues that the counties have talked about here today, property tax limitations and an end of activity on federal forest lands, the latter of which never directly benefited cities, who are never the recipients of those funds, but increased activity in those areas boosted up property values and economic activity. We just had a hearing a couple hours ago about how the closure of a mill and Sweet Home devastated that city's property tax base. So spreading that across other taxing districts doesn't seem like a stable or sustainable solution to the problem. So we'd encourage this committee to look elsewhere for solutions. Some ideas, exploring how other states fund assessment and taxation, exploring if there are efficiencies out there through doing it regionally. The other issue that Gil didn't raise, but I believe was included in the recommendations from the 2009 report, were increasing the recording fees, some of the money of which goes to fund assessment and taxation. $9 or $10 of those fees currently goes to fund assessment and taxation, and 15 goes to emergency and low-income housing. Perhaps that allocation needs to be increased. Those fees need to be increased. Perhaps the distribution needs to be changed. But we think there are other solutions out there that would more holistically try to address this issue rather than access to unsegregated accounts.
Representative Berger.
Is there more testimony?
We are through with the testimony.
It's my memory in these bills that we passed last time that what it set up was a a sort of an overseeing group that would, it, but it was geared at that time around public safety and who would be in the sort of position to allocate resources from the state down to these counties. There is no mention of this in here. And I kind of feel uncomfortable those knots aren't tied. In other words, there's this overseeing group. Who do they deal with how the state gets paid? How does that work? I mean, I know we're in new territory here, but I don't see those knots being tied. And Gil, you remember that discussion about this overseeing group that composed of the county commissioners and some state folks? And those knots aren't tied in here in terms of governance. And I would feel better if they were tied in terms of governance over these functions. There's a lot of functions we're not thinking about that would also come in there. And I'm also disturbed a little about this who pays for what issue, because we've got a county that's broke. And we've got this overseeing group that comes in and says, here's how we're going to allocate public safety. And oh, by the way, we're also going to do taxation and you're going to pay for it, but you're broke. And we're going to do county services and we're going to fee you for that and we're broke. But the Secretary of State's going to take care of elections, so don't worry about that. That's what I'm seeing here, and I'm just not sure we've got a cogent policy yet.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Representative Berger's concern, and I guess I go back to last session when we did pass House Bill 4176, which was the initial bill that allowed the governing body to seek a declaration of fiscal emergency. And previous to that, the governor was able to also declare that emergency as well, but that was changed to where the county now makes that decision, the governing body. Now, my concern is essentially that the county is not providing services at some level, as I described around public safety earlier, where our jails are, closing. And our jail beds are closing, and we have no sheriffs patrolling the county anymore, or maybe just one or two. And the state is now, through default, actually providing or trying to provide those services around public safety, yet, and actually paying for those. And I believe that situation is actually happening today. And the state's paying for those services to provide public safety calls that come from that county, and I'm curious, what's the criteria for the governing body of the county to say, okay, we're in a public safety crisis, we need to declare this emergency, or can they just ignore the emergency entirely, and the state will continue to provide those services? Not saying it's happening right now, but I really see us moving sort of that direction, and worried about, it's sort of like the reverse of a mandate on the state to provide county services now without any payment to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, there isn't now a situation where there's money changing hands from the state to the county to fill in the patrol and so on. The counties are working closely with the state police, but there's only so much the state police can do, and so they're working in a collaborative means.
Follow up. My question really is the state shifting its resources to provide that lack of service being provided by the county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, not to an extent to make up for what, I'm probably not the primary source on this, but I don't believe that there's much of that happening, because you hear now about lack of 24-hour patrol service, and it continues. The Oregon State Police does not have the mandate or the tools or the personnel to take over that function, and they haven't. In terms of declaration of emergency, I would say first and foremost, you have an elected governing body who's dealing with very difficult, and has been for some time, dealing with very difficult budget issues. And at some point, I believe, being seasoned enough, they would know that they can't do any more. and that the situation is dire, and so they would declare an emergency, ask the governor to confirm that. Fortunately, we haven't gotten to that point, and I hope we don't.
Further questions? All right, thank you, panel. All right, that's it for the testimony. I think we've raised a number of questions. This bill, I think, needs some additional discussion before we move anything, although I think there's a core policy here that needs to be dealt with, especially on the property tax collection. So I want to continue this discussion, but for now we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2206. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2407, which is the is that the political? That's the political tax credit bill. We heard this on the 18th. And what I'd like to do with both these tax credits is move them today to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. But I open it up to committee discussion. We had some good discussion on the 18th, although our discussion on the political credit got cut a little bit short. So before we have a motion, members, I welcome your speaking up as to your views on, we are the policy committee for these tax credits, and before we refer them to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, it's appropriate to discuss our views of the policy and any recommendation or not as to continuation. So are there comments on this bill? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would refer you to the document called the Tax Credit Committee Policy Questions, which the which is in our packet this afternoon. And this policy question set was determined, was put together by the, I think it's essentially the co-chairs of the Tax Credit Committee in 2011. There may be a couple of minor changes in it, but the idea of the committee at that point was that the policy committees ought to figure out whether or not the policy for the tax credit is an appropriate policy for the state of Oregon to spend money on. whether the goal of the credit is one that we ought to have as part of the policy of the state of Oregon. And whether or not, I mean, then all these other sub-questions sort of come in under that. Does the policy committee believe that, is it able to describe the purpose of the credit? Is it able to describe who benefits from it? Is it able to describe the target of the credit? What would happen if the credit simply went away, simply sunsetted? And I think that one of the things, and I wasn't one of the co-chairs of the Tax Credit Committee at the time, so I'm speaking for them, but I think I can speak for myself as a current co-chair of the Tax Credit Committee, that we were expecting, the Tax Credit Committee is expecting that bills come from the policy committees only if the policy committee believes that the tax credit should not be sunsetted, because that gives some guidance then to the Tax Credit Committee. And of course, if they don't get the bill, then there's nothing for the Tax Credit Committee to do. Now, that isn't strictly speaking true. The reality is, of course, that these are likely to come through in a general tax credit bill, and that has a broad enough relating clause so that other things could be pulled in, including things that did not come from a policy committee. But I can tell you that it would be very influential to me if neither the Senate nor the House Policy Committee sent us a tax credit for renewal. I'd take that as a pretty strong assumption that they didn't think it was a good thing mm-hmm. for us to do. And frankly, given our budget situation, that would be welcome if the committees actually thought that about those tax credits. And then, that we go on, what would be the effect of reducing the credit by 50%? I would think I could add to that, what would be the effect of adding a a means test to a credit. It might apply to this credit, for example, so that only people whose income is below a certain level could take the credit. Finally, things like, is this an effective way to achieve our policy goal? Is a tax credit the way to do it? Should we be considering something else? Maybe we ought to send some kind of a policy to the Ways and Means Committee for a package to the Ways and Means Committee for their consideration. And then finally, how does this fit in with other things that are already happening, federal tax expenditures, local subsidies, and so forth? And then at the end, is there a way of modifying it to make it more effective or efficient? And if so, how? And I admit this is a tall order from the Tax Credit Committee, but I think for the scheme to work, the idea that policy committees consider these tax credits first, you almost have to assume that the policy committees will take at least some of these questions and attempt to answer them in their report to the to the Tax Credit Committee to help give that committee guidance on what it ought to do as it struggles with the issue that we have no money and that a renewal of any credit reduces the budget by the amount of the credit.
I think some of these questions are a little bit beyond the capacity of this committee to really delve into. And that's why I think it says that these are the questions that the Joint Committee on Tax Credits intends to address. I think we should weigh in on what the public policy purpose is and whether this credit achieves it. Some of these questions are pretty refined, though, about what are the administrative and compliance costs and what other incentives are available. I don't think we can answer those questions here. And so my preference would be that we have a high-level discussion about whether we think this is a legitimate public policy and whether this credit meaningfully serves it. And then I think we've done our job at that point. Representative Berger.
Speaking as past co-chair of the Tax Credit Committee, I can tell you that you don't have some of the information to answer these questions, and the Tax Credit Committee will. I will also tell you that in terms of cutting things in half and racking back or whatever, in the last cycle, we literally were told what our budget was for all tax credits. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a matter of, well, this one should be half or this one should be this. It was, here's how much money, here's how to fit it into the slot. So some were reduced significantly just because of that. So I don't know that will be our charge this time. Certainly that we don't have as big a book, as expensive a book to try and reduce. But I agree with you, Mr. Chair, that you can't opine on a lot of these things. You don't have the data. Representative Barnhart has it exactly right. If you don't send a tax credit to the committee, we would consider, policy committee doesn't see its value, it's gone. So the motion before us is cogent and important today, at any level.
Other comments, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that input from the people that have served on the Joint Tax Credit Committee before, because I've looked at these questions before and came to the same conclusion that my particular committee did not have the expertise to answer all these questions. But looking at the high level on the tax credit for political contributions, I actually support that tax credit. I think it serves a very good purpose of allowing participation in the political process. Essentially, poor people have a chance at running for office because they can convince people to contribute to them, in a way that enhances their ability to garner money to run for office, because we all know it takes a little bit of money, a minimal amount at least, to run for office, usually effectively. So I think that from my standpoint, this tax credit does serve a purpose, and I don't see that diminishing that. It would be helpful to that purpose. So just speaking about that aspect of it, I guess generally, I'd be in favor of sending this tax credit on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee to answer the questions I cannot.
Well stated. Representative Kenemer.
Yeah, I think the tax credit should definitely be extended. A couple of things about it, I agree with yours. I think also it's a good way for people to start making a connection and getting involved in the public process. It's an inexpensive commitment, but when people make a financial commitment to something, it makes a difference in how they perform. And I think that's a value to them and to our society. Also think it encourages them to vote, and we know that getting people out to vote is getting harder and harder. The other part is it helps fund people so you can learn about what the issues are. It's amazing, but I think campaigns are a lot about informing the people about the issues. and a lot of people are not aware of that, and these help fund those, and like Paul said, they give people a chance to get involved that might not otherwise get involved.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I agree with everything that's been said. I am a strong supporter of the political tax credit. I think it really does play an important role in getting people involved, especially for the first time, and especially lower-income people. Because it's a tax credit, people are able to take the credit who otherwise may not have deductions, really. So I think this is one that really does help low-income people. You know, I would not be opposed to some sort of means testing on this tax credit if the joint committee, sees that it needs to be trimmed somewhat. But that seems to be, within the purview of the committee as they're looking at whatever targets they're looking at for overall tax expenditures. I would say, I'll speak to the cultural trust when we get to that.
Okay, thank you. Are there further, Representative Jensen, please.
Just a question before, are we talking specifically about 2407? Or
yes, we're just doing the political tax credit right now.
Tax credit, right. Tax credits in general, I'm opposed to. And I say that after having made a significant amount of money off of tax credits, but it was money that only served one purpose, and that was to build the coffers of the recipients of the tax credits. And in relationship, however, to 2407, I would tend to compromise my position a little on that. Not so much that I have found it a useful means of raising money in campaigns, and I have had to at times raise significant amounts of money. For a couple of the other arguments I think that have been made here, I think it is a good entree into the political process for a lot of people. It's kind of like a car dealer. If you want to sell somebody a car, you got to get them started answering yes to questions. And the same thing is kind of true as far as the tax credit for a political type contribution. It's a way of getting, and this is not that it addresses a particular person or a particular campaign. I'm thinking about it generically in that it's a way of setting the hook, if you please, in people to get them to participating in the political process. You know, the $1,500 tax credit to your big contributors could make less difference to them. It's totally insignificant. You know, to some person that's been kind of passive, you know, $10, you know, it's a good way to start getting them saying yes to the political process. Not, you know, so I would tend to be supportive of continuation of the tax credit, income tax credit on political contributions, even though I generally do not care for the idea of tax credits and would be happy to bore you with some significant amount of research about the ineffectiveness, political ineffectiveness of them, economic ineffectiveness of them.
All right, thank you. Anybody else like to weigh in? Okay, so we're in work session. I'll just say for the record, I agree with Representative Dembro that I think some examination of means testing would be appropriate for this, but I don't think that this committee, even if this committee agreed with that, I don't know that we could peg an amount without having access to the data that we lack. So I'm not going to, I prefer that we not try and settle that question, and the bill will be moved to the committee with an analysis and a summary of what we discussed, one of which is that the joint committee should explore the issue of means testing. So I think we have settled the discussion, and I would entertain a motion to move this bill.
Without recommendation, right?
So the question before us is whether we want to move the bill without recommendation or with recommendation. And my sense of the committee is that we would prefer to move the bill to the joint committee with recommendation that the tax credit be extended in some form.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to make that motion. Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2407 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent subsequent reference, we it gets referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, something like that.
Is there a discussion? Oh, I need to repeat the motion. Don't I? Representative, I have to repeat what you just said.
Yeah, well, I move House Bill 2407 with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to Joint Committee on Tax Credit by prior reference. That's a much simpler.
Vice Chair Holvey moves House Bill 2407 with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there discussion on this motion? We've already discussed it, so there shouldn't be. Representative Dembro.
Yeah, before we vote, I do have a question. Will the committee report, you know, indicate that the committee did discuss the notion of means testing?
I've been told that's where you're.
Along with several other factors.
Thank you.
Further discussion. Is there objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and House Bill 2407 is moved. All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2407. We have one more to do. I'll open a public work session on House Bill 2470. This is the cultural tax credit. We also heard this on the 18th.
Yeah.
And we now need to go through the same exercise we just went through. So I won't do the usual preliminary. I just invite committee members to speak to their views about the wisdom of this tax credit and whether we should extend it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kenemer.
Yeah. You know, I have been one who's utilized this, and I'm a strong believer in the program. A couple of different things about this is, first of all, I don't think it should be sunsetted, because I think the development and preservation of our cultural heritage and the other issues related to that is part of making our society a special place. And the difficulty with these kinds of things is how do you get the seed money to make some of these things happen? And I think that, well, you know, if you're going to put them against hardcore items in the budget, they're not going to fare well. I mean, if I've got to choose between teachers in the classroom and the cultural trust head on, that's not going to work. But that's not to say that the cultural trust isn't mighty important and a piece. You know, I recently went to Clackamas Community College and enjoyed a couple of the plays that they had, which were partially funded through this kind of a program. You know, those kids are getting a fabulous experience, and we got a treat to go watch and a reduced rate. I think these are the things that make our society extraordinary, not just special, but extraordinary, and I think they merit our support.
Thank you. Representative Denbrough.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm also a very strong supporter of the cultural trust. You know, I've seen, I think, you know, we do tend to think, when we think of culture, we think of high culture. And certainly, you know, things like, you know, ballet and symphonies and, you know, et cetera, are, you know, some of what the cultural trust funds. But it also funds community-based kinds of, you know, really diverse programming. My own direct connection with the trust has been its support for the Cascade Festival of African Films, which is a real community-building kind of activity that, you know, really needs that kind of support. So you know, I do, you know, really support what it does. I also have to say candidly, my first session here, 2009, I think we did something to that fund.
Yes.
And I remember...
It was called a sweep.
Yeah, I didn't want to use that word. there was a diversion that happened. And boy, was my email full of people letting me know how much this meant to them. I think it is a very popular program. And, you know, again, you know, I don't know, looking at that... you know, if means testing is something that would be appropriate for this fund, I don't know if, you know, any kind of collaring or whatever would be appropriate. But, you know, I think that the revenue, the Joint Tax Committee, you know, would be best able to look at that.
Thank you. This is one where it seems to me that even though, like the political tax credit, it benefits largely people of higher incomes. You know, the arts and public art benefits the whole community, and this is one way of making sure that happens. So, although I philosophically share a lot of Representative Jensen's skepticism about tax credits, I find myself in this committee with two of them that I happen to actually support. So, did I miss some? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to chime in with that sentiment as well. I did kind of was concerned about how much this benefits wealthier contributors, but I think your comment is, I just want to echo that. I see a lot of positive impact from the results of the investments that are made from the dollars that go into this tax credit in terms of supplementing education for children, especially in our schools, with some of the programs that are developed around this, whether it's music or art or some other things. And then, you know, as I look at the purpose of this, you know, increasing cultural development in Oregon, and I think it bears mentioning the impact that the arts are having on our economy in many regions with that study that was referenced, that Oregon was part of a national study on the amount of added value that's coming from businesses and small businesses and entrepreneurs in the arts, and how Oregon is really doing well with art being an economic driver for many of our small areas, our rural areas, and many small businesses as well. And so I see a real added value to this this tax credit and would be inclined to support it, not sunsetting and moving this on to the joint tax credit committee and let them tussle about whether it should be means tested. I'm not sure it really means testing works for the purpose of this particular tax credit.
It may not. Further discussion before we, Representative Jensen.
Don't ask me to sin three times.
Call the question.
you do have another tax credit that I have some sympathy and support for. It's sometimes a little hard for me to get too excited, however, about a tax credit when somebody pulls into the little airport in Joseph in their Gulfstream and picks up $1 million bronze to take back to some place that wouldn't have the vaguest idea what it was all about. And if someone wants to do that, bless them. But I don't feel real good about getting tax credits down into some of these areas. However, the intention, and I think the intention was well served here, was to promote, cultural trust in Oregon. I think it has done an effective job of that, but please don't push your luck any further today.
Well, luckily we don't have any more tax credits in this committee, Representative, and I'm thankful for that. So is there further discussion before we have a motion? So, Representative Holvey, you want to try again?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, which one was this? 2470. With a due pass recommendation, the tax bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Holvey moves House Bill 2470 with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none. Motion passes, and House Bill 2470 is so moved. That completes our business. Committee is adjourned.